Good morning. Is this Mr. Otis Littlejohn?
Yes, it is.
This is Janice Kozlowski with the National Park Service in Anchorage.
Yes, ma'am.
Is this morning going to be a good time to talk?
Oh, yeah. Okay. That'll be all right.
And is it okay if I tape the conversation?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right.
But you're going to tell me when you start, huh?
Well, I turned the tape recorder on already.
Okay.
Is it okay to get going with it?
Oh, yeah, that'll be fine.
Okay. Okay, so can I start asking you questions?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so could you tell me how you ended up getting into World War II? Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted. November 4th, 1941.
And what compelled you to do that?
I was 20 years old, and at that time where I lived, there was no jobs around, and I'd already been in the Civilian Conservation Corps a year and a half, and so I just was ready to leave home, and I decided the Navy would be a good place to spend 30 years.
So you?
But I didn't. I enlisted for 6 years and got out in a little under 6 years.
And why did you pick the Navy?
Well, I've been asked that question before, and it's hard to answer. I knew a man that had been in the Marines, and that didn't appeal to me because of what he said. And I just didn't think I'd like the Army, and so the Navy was the first choice.
Did you have other family members that had been in the Navy, or was there anything in your... in your past that kind of compelled you that way?
No. I had two uncles in the Army, but no other relatives in the service that I knew of.
Okay. And did you always live in Louisiana?
No. I was born in Jefferson, Texas. And that's only about 50, 60 miles from here.
Oh, so you didn't move too far from home?
No. Well, I lived up in Illinois almost 10 years, counting the time I was in the Navy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I got married up there.
You met your wife up in Illinois?
She was in the Navy, too. She was a Navy nurse.
Oh.
She was gold braid, and I wasn't, but we didn't have any problem going together, so she got out of the Navy and before I did, and when I got out, I came home to Texas and stayed a little while and went back up there and we got married.
Oh, okay.
Lived up there several years after that.
And then she moved down to Louisiana with you?
Well, I convinced her to come down here. You know, I worked up there and I didn't like that cold climate. I told her I knew a place where it was warmer.
Yeah,
and I convinced her, and we moved down here in 1954.
Oh, well, she must have liked it then. She stayed.
Well, the first summer we lived down here is one of the hottest summers that Shreveport ever had, and she was pregnant, so it was pretty hard to convince her to stay, but she did.
And did the two of you ever serve together in the Navy?
Well, we were at the same base, but same. She was in a different category. She was a dietitian in the hospital where they served special meals for special patients.
Oh, I see.
And I was in the police department.
Okay. So what kind of training did the Navy give you, and where did they train you when you got into the service?
I went enlisted in Texarkana, Texas, and they sent me to Little Rock, and that's where I was actually inducted, and then went to San Diego, and we had a boot camp there, and so we were about halfway through training, and when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, so we didn't finish training. We got shipped to Pearl Harbor.
When did you end up in Pearl Harbor then? How quickly after the bombing?
Well, let's see, we got there, I think it was like the 15th, and they sent us there, and we first thing we did was unload an ammunition ship. And that took about 2 or 3 weeks. And then I went aboard ship on January 10th in 42. And that's where I spent almost 3 years.
And where did that ship, where were your missions on that ship?
First we patrolled around Hawaiian Islands, anti-submarine patrol and radar patrol. And we'd go out and stay even 7 to 9 days, and we'd come back into port for supplies and refuel. And so we spent several months doing that. And one day we got a call to go out and check on a submarine that sunk a small freighter. So we went from Oahu over to Hawaii Island, and there's two other ships with us, and we sunk that submarine. We got credit for it, and our commander got a better command, but all we got was a pat on the back.
No steak dinner or anything?
No, nothing special. But after that, then we went to San Francisco and got new equipment, like radar, for instance, well, a better radar. And then on the way to Alaska.
Now tell me, what ship were you on?
USS Long.
And what kind
DMS,
of...
DMS 12.
And what kind of ship was the USS Long?
It was a World War One series of destroyers, and it's what they call a four-piper, as four stacks, and they took one of them out and put a fuel tank in there so we could stay out at sea longer, but they converted it to a minesweeper. So it was called a high-speed minesweeper, and so that was our main job. You know, clearing harbors of mines.
So you started out clearing mines in the Hawaiian Islands?
No. The first ones we did was in the Aleutians.
Oh, okay. So you went from Hawaii up to Alaska on the Long?
No, we went from Hawaii to San Francisco and got repairs and remodeling, and then went to the Aleutians.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So we went up there in July of 42, and, you know, the fog is so thick. You know how that fog is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we were out there maneuvering and, you know, zigzagging. We had a fleet there, and there's two ships didn't get the order, so one of them rammed us. And I had just come down from the bridge, and I happened to look up, and I saw that thing coming at us. It looked like a battleship. So I yelled on the bridge right quick, you know, ship on the starboard side. And so, by that time, of course, we tried to go reverse, and they tried to steer starboard, but they rammed us and knocked a big hole in the side, and then slapped along the side and knocked another big hole in the rear. And the fog lifted right away, and there they were sitting out there with the bow turned 90 degrees.
Wow.
So nobody got hurt, but the same thing happened to two other ships in the same fleet at the same time. Of course, we got orders to go back to base. There's nothing we could do, so we got temporary repairs at Kodiak, and then back to San Francisco for major repairs, and then right back to the Aleutians.
Well, that sounds like it was a pretty big accident. It's surprising nobody got hurt.
Yeah, it just the way it hit, I guess. They hit us up close to the forecastle, and since I happened to be where I was the first one up on the forecastle after the accident. And laying up on our deck, there was a box of tongue depressors. It came from their sick bay.
Oh, it just came flying out?
It came flying out of their sick bay onto our main deck. But, like I said, when the fog lifted, there we were, four ships, and unable to do anything. So we went back to Kodiak about 3 or 4 knots. That's all we could make.
Well, it took you 3 or 4 nights to get there, or you stayed there?
Not. 3 or 4 knots, the speed.
Oh, knots. Oh, I'm sorry.
Barely moving.
Oh, okay. And so it probably took you... Where were you at the time when the accident occurred?
I don't know exactly.
But maybe not very close to Kodiak.
Well, not real close, no. It was somewhere further out, maybe toward Dutch Harbor, somewhere out that way.
Do you remember what the other ship... name was?
I do. In fact, I've got it. Monahan.
Oh, the Monahan. Okay.
And that happened on the 27th of July.
In 42?
Right.
Okay. So you made it, you limped into Kodiak, and they were able to do enough to put the ship together so you could sail to San Francisco?
Right, right.
And did you have any trouble getting to San Francisco?
No trouble. They repaired it well enough to go, and, no leak or no storm, apparently. I don't remember exactly, but we made it all right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how about the Monahan? What happened to that? Do you know?
No, I don't. I think I'm right that the Monahan was sunk in a storm in the South Pacific later.
Oh.
A year or two later.
Okay.
I remember it was four ships that were sunk in this storm, and Monahan was one of them.
Okay. So what happened after that? How long did you stay in San Francisco, or what did you do after you left there?
Well, probably no more than a month. I know that we were there long enough for some of the men to get leave to go home, and I don't remember if I went or not, but I was lucky enough to get home every year, once a year, and I'd get a week's leave, plus, 2 days before and 2 days after, so that'd be 11 days, and it'd take me 6 days on the road, so I'd get 5 days at home.
Oh, I bet that one.
After I got transferred from the ship, 2 or 3 years later, I got a 36-day leave, and then later, when I was at Great Lakes, I got another 30-day leave. So I was lucky about getting to go home.
What did you do when you went home? Did you go visit your girlfriend?
Yeah. Once at least, and of course that didn't turn out too good, but that didn't matter.
But you visited your family.
Oh yeah. I went home and visited and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good to be home.
So how was it? Well, you hadn't been in Alaska very long, so you didn't really probably know what you were getting into at that point when you first got leave out of San Francisco.
No, of course, when we left San Francisco the first time, we had no idea where we were going because they don't tell you ahead of time because everything is a secret. They don't want the news out, where the fleet is going or where they're going to meet and all that. So when we got out to sea a little ways, they issued us some cold weather clothing and headed north. So, of course, then we knew exactly where we were going. And we got there, well, at first we had the collision and then went back up there a second time in September and stayed up there a whole year and left up there in September the next year. And that was a cold, cold year. That fog in the summertime, you couldn't see where you were going, and cold and wind and ice in the wintertime, and standing gun watch up on the top deck, and of course, it was rough, and I wouldn't want to go back up there. My daughter and son-in-law was up there in Anchorage and Fairbanks last September, and they enjoyed it. Of course, that was on the mainland, and I never was on the mainland. It was up and down the Aleutians and Kodiak and up into the Bering Sea and all over the place. We went to Dutch Harbor. Oh, we must have been there 100 times, and Adak and Attu and several others, Amchitka, Atka, Kodiak, all those islands we were.
Boy, it sounds like you hit all the ports there.
Oh, yeah, we were in every port up there. You know, of course, all the islands didn't have ports at that time. But we made them all, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest base for you in the Aleutians? Or was there one?
The biggest base?
Mm-hmm.
I guess Dutch Harbor. We were in there more than others, and Kodiak, and later Kiska, and Attu, of course. We never went into a port there, but, you know, I mentioned to you the other day that I was on the island of Attu during the battle, and I was the coxswain of a 17-foot motor whale boat, and with a three-man crew. We took an officer over on the island for some reason, I don't know what, and he got out of the boat and went over the hill, and so we had to stay with the boat. And I got out and walked around the island, and I could see the war going on up on the side of the mountain with all the smoke from the guns, and I could see men running around up there, but I couldn't tell which was which. But that's when the war was going on right that minute, and that was in May, I believe, and I remember walking around there, and the flowers were coming up through the tundra.
Oh.
And people up there on the side of the mountain getting killed and freezing to death, and, you know, they had lost their fingers and toes up there from bad weather.
Did you actually see some of that going on when you were on the island, or did some of them end up back on your ship, those wounded people or dead people?
No, we never got any of them. But I read about it later, about how that happened with their losing their toes and their fingers, and it was just... Well, it was, you know, it was, even though it was May and June, it was still cold up in those mountains. And, well, as far as I was concerned, it was cold everywhere.
Right, so you could see how that could happen to someone, frozen toes and fingers, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because of the conditions they had, didn't have housing and no way to protect themselves from the weather, and they dig these foxholes and get down in there where it was wet and muddy, and it's easy to understand how that would happen.
And where was your ship anchored out off of Attu? Was it Massacre Bay or Holtz Bay? Do you remember?
No, we were never anchored there.
Oh.
No, when that time we left the ship to take this officer over there, the ship was still cruising around, and then when we'd go back, of course, it was easy enough to see the ship in the daytime, but one time we had to go out at night, and we had a signalman with us, and we got out there in the middle of the ocean, and the doggone motor conked out, and the engineer, you know, couldn't get it started, so we had to signal back to the ship, and we had this shotgun-type signal gun, and it took him quite a while to find the ship. Just kept going around the horizon until he finally located them and told them what the problem was, and so the chief engineer told him what to do, and he did, and got the thing started. So then they asked what we should do next, because we'd already spent an hour out there floating around. So they said, well, come on back to the ship. We did. We never did take this officer that where we were supposed to that night, you know.
That's a bad combination in the Aleutians, dark and weathered and no engine.
Yeah. We kept floating toward the island. And, of course, at that time, we didn't know what was over there. And but I guess it all worked out. I'm still here.
Yeah. So during the Battle of Attu, how long was your ship around the island?
Well, all the time during the battle.
Oh, okay.
Patrolling around there and anti-submarine patrol and radar, you know, because in case the Japanese planes came, we were there to do what we could.
Did you see any Japanese planes?
Not at that particular time, but we saw some later when around Amchitka they came in two different days. I think it was like December 31st and January 1st, and they're dropping bombs around there. Of course, earlier they had bombed Dutch Harbor, and you know, that was before they invaded Attu and Kiska, and they killed quite a few people in that bombing raids.
Were you anywhere near Dutch Harbor when that happened?
No, that's when the Japanese invaded Attu and Kiska, that we were still down in the South Pacific.
Did you hear anything about it?
No, we didn't know anything about it. And at that time, no. That's like nowadays, there's thousands and thousands of people that never heard of the war in the Aleutians. I talk to people all the time that never heard of it. But I try to tell them all I can about it, because I like for people to know about where I spent a year of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A miserable year.
What made it so miserable in Alaska?
The weather.
Just primarily the weather.
Oh, yeah. Well, people have asked me about how I felt in the war with the Japanese and all that, but you don't spend time thinking about that. You just take care of the situation at hand. And if they shoot at you, you shoot back at them, and you don't worry about all those things. But the weather itself, it was just, I can't even think of the word to call it. It was terrible. And cold and windy and ice. One time we came into the harbor and the ship was just covered with ice. And just, I mean, like the safety cables all the way around, they were about four or five times the size they should be. And just everything was solid ice. And the so heavy we were even sinking down into the water. And we got into port, they passed the word, all hands chip ice. Well, that meant the engineers and everybody. So we were up there chipping ice off the entire ship, all the way up to the top decks, all the way down to the waterline. So much ice.
Wow.
And one time in particular, I remember we were went to the recreation hall one night, and that we had to walk back to the ship all the way around the harbor, which was about 3 miles, and the wind and ice was blowing so hard and sleeting that we had to back into it, and then till we got around to the curve, and then we'd walk forward. But we got back to the ship, this one man's beard was solid ice.
Oh, boy.
Oh, it was pretty cold. But. And another time I was going in my boat, this 17-foot whale boat, across the harbor, which is like 3 miles or so. And it was going to be dark when I got back. So I picked out a mountain for a guideline, so I could see it at night coming back. On the way back, this one officer is riding with us, and he told me, said, "Little John, he's a little bit starboard." I said, "Okay." So I'd go a little bit starboard, and when he's not paying attention, I'd get back in line with that mountain. So we'd go a little further, you know, "Little John, you're off course, a little bit starboard." Said, "Yes, sir." So I'd do what he said, and then when he's not paying attention, I'd get back on my mountain. So we made it back to the ship, and he says, "Yeah, see, we made it." "Yes, sir, we sure did."
you had the balance doing what you were told with doing what you knew was the right thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had sense enough to pick out that mountain because I knew it was going to be pitch dark coming back, and there's, you know, it's dark as ship. There's no lights. I mean, this harbor is dark. I mean, you can't even hardly see your hand in front of you.
Which harbor were you in at that time?
Well, I've been looking at maps later, and I think it must have been Dutch Harbor because the way it's laid out there, you know, mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly, but I think that was probably where it was.
Uh-huh. Do you remember any other weather-related stories or things that happened that were memorable?
Oh, yeah. One time we were tied up in Kodiak for 31 days. We had a problem with the propeller or impeller, whichever they call it, and ordered a new one. And after about 2 weeks, we hadn't heard anything about it, so they reordered it, and come to find out the order never went through. So we had to wait another 2 weeks and then a few days to put it on. So we were there 31 days. But we would go to classes and lectures and things like that. So one day we went to this lecture, which was a couple miles from the ship, and the weather was pretty nice. And we came out of there, and boy, this thing, there's a storm. You know, they call those willow-waws, mm-hmm. those sudden storms that come up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sleeting and snowing, and boy, it was a terrible storm. So here we are walking. And so finally this one guy suggested, "Why don't we call a motor pool? Maybe we can get somebody to pick us up." So we had this one officer with us, and he called a motor pool, and sure enough, somebody came to pick us up in an open Jeep and got us back to the ship. But that was one of the worst storms I was ever in, with the blowing ice. Oh, man, it's blowing so if it hits you in the face, it cuts your face.
Mm.
And but that wasn't the only time. I mean, those storms would come regularly out at sea, wind blowing. I don't know how those people live up there, but they do.
Did the weather have a big effect on your ship, or was your ship large enough that it was still pretty comfortable?
It was comfortable in your living quarters, but we all stood gun watches, and you had to be up there. Your gun watch was 4 hours, and you had to spend 4 hours in the weather regardless of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
No, we used to take turns going down below and, like, down to the ammunition room and get warmed up a little bit. And you could spend 10 minutes down there, and you'd come back up and let somebody else go. But there was no real good way to keep warm. We'd cover up with these big canvas gun covers, and but that was your duty, and you had to do it.
Well, did the equipment that they issued you in San Francisco, was it adequate for Alaska?
Yeah, it was. We had heavy denim, I guess you call it, pants and jacket. And the jacket, well, I think they were both Berland or some kind of lining in them. And then one time I spent quite a while over on the island when I had a sickness problem. They sent me over there to the hospital. And while I was over there, I got an Army jacket and Army shoes. And when I finally made it back to the ship, I'd wear them aboard ship. One day, one of the officers said to me, he says, "You know, you're out of uniform." I said, "Yes, sir, I know it." Said, "Don't you think you ought to put your Navy shoes on?" I said, "Yes, sir." I never did. I wore those Army shoes until I wore them out.
Were they better than what the Navy gave you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were better. They were heavier and came up further on your ankles and all. And they were better. They were made for land use, and ours were not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the jacket was good. It really wasn't any better than ours, but it was longer, and it was better, a little better.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when you were on the ship, you manned the guns on your shift, and you also operated this whale boat. Were those your primary duties?
Yeah, I was a 20-millimeter gunner, yeah. That was my military duties, 20-millimeter, and we never did get to shoot it, you know, in the real war part of it, except this one time. This plane dove down on us, and we got to shoot at him, but he went back into a cloud. But after that, we got a letter from the Navy saying this certain ammunition was no good, so that lot number so-and-so, and that turned out that's what we had. So even if I hit the plane, I didn't hit him in the right spot, but... And some of us said that I did hit him, but I wouldn't swear to it. But the projectile was supposed to explode when it hits, but it didn't. That's why it was defective and it didn't explode. Anyway, he got away.
Was that around Amchitka that you saw? Because you mentioned you saw some airplanes there.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. That was at Amchitka, yeah. Yeah, they used to come over pretty regular, but they'd fly so doggone high, you know, what they were actually kind of like reconnaissance planes. But some of them would drop bombs on the airfield that we were trying to build there, and they'd drop bombs on it. And, of course, then you'd have to go repair it, so it took quite a few days longer to get it built.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up there, there wasn't too many Japanese planes, and most of them got shot down, and they didn't resupply them.
Right.
Like we would have.
How about U.S. airplanes? Did you see many of those?
Many of which planes?
Any of the Allied Air Force? The U.S.
Oh, yeah.
Or Canadian
yeah.
planes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They'd come around. They were flying regularly. One time we were out in the fog, and we could hear this PBY flying around and around and around up there. And finally the fog lifted a little bit, and he signaled down. He said, "Request not the word, but he requests a way home to ADAC. And the captain read the message, and he says, send this back to him. Request same. So apparently he made it back, and we did too, but we're cruising around between those islands, and the radar man was reporting land astern. And radar wasn't really perfected at that time, or at least ours wasn't. And then all of a sudden, the man up in the crow's nest yelled, land straight ahead. Well, radar showed it in the rear.
Oh.
But we managed to change course before we hit it. But that's the way that fog was. You know, you'd get between those islands, and it's pretty hard maneuvering.
And the radar was not well perfected at that time, right?
Right.
Yeah. So
I think that's what they call a reciprocal echo.
And
if that makes sense.
I'm not quite sure how those things work, but could the fog could have mixed the signal?
That's a possibility, but not being perfected at that time. You know, sometimes it just wouldn't work right. So
okay.
It's something you had to put up with. Later they perfected all that, you know.
So on the ship, do you have any idea how many guys were on the ship with you?
Oh yeah. It run from 120 to 140. Sometimes they would send us replacements, and we'd get too many. In other words, we didn't have room, didn't have enough bunks for them, and they'd have to sleep, well, down in the Pacific. Of course, they could sleep on deck or anywhere they wanted to, but they'd try to keep the crew to where everybody had a bunk to sleep in, and if they sent us too many men, then they'd just get rid of some. And so it runs from 120 to 140.
And where did the personnel exchanges occur?
Well, sometimes people would get sick and they get transferred, or if they made got advanced rank, and then we would have too many of a certain rank, and they'd transfer them to a bigger ship or, you know, some other duty. And I don't remember exactly why, but they were transferring people right and left, and so that's the way the ship would vary in personnel.
And where did the exchanges occur, on at Dutch Harbor or Kodiak, or do you remember that?
No, not particularly, but it would be when we were in port that people would leave. I know this one fellow was always so seasick he couldn't do anything, so he was aboard there 2 or 3 weeks, and the first chance we got, went into a port, they transferred him because he, you know, he wasn't capable of doing anything. So, you know, he got transferred to a land base.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people would I can't think of the word, they'd leave. AWOL.
Really? So they would just jump off ship and never not get back on?
Right. When we were in San Francisco one time, I was on guard duty on the dock, and this fellow came by and just came walking up there, and he says, hey, you got a pencil? He says, I want to make a phone call. I want to write down a number. So the phone booth was right outside the gate. And I loaned him a pencil, and he went into the phone booth, and I didn't pay attention to him. And when I had my back turned, he took off. Haven't seen him since.
Oh.
Of course, I never did tell anybody that he passed me and got out.
Oh, yeah. Would you have gotten in trouble for that?
Possibly, but I never gave it much thought. And when he showed, you know, when time come for a roll call or whatever, and he wasn't there, of course, they knew what happened. He left, but nobody ever asked me if he went by me or what. So I kept quiet about it.
Well, what was the kind of the feeling on the ship? What kind of morale did people have? Did they not like their duties there in the Aleutians or on board that ship? Did you have a sense for that?
No, everybody got along. Well, no, I wouldn't say everybody. But generally, it was a good crew, and we used to play cards, just pass the time, and it wasn't bad at all, because you had to make the best of it, and why be grouchy and all that kind of stuff when you're going to be there anyway? So you make the best of it. And this one man in particular always had a chip on his shoulder, and he got into several different fights, and including with me. One night we headed out on the galley deck house, and he beat the heck out of me, so that's the last time I tried to fight anybody.
Oh. Do you remember what the fight was over?
Oh, yeah. My duty was to wake men up and when it was time for them to go on watch during the night or in the daytime. And so I'd wake him up and he'd grunt and groan. He wouldn't want to get up. So I'd have to go back and call him the second time, sometime the third time. So I lit into him pretty good about it. But he being a grouchy fighting type anyway, he wanted to fight about it. And he called me some dirty name that I didn't like, so I hit him right in the nose as hard as I could. I think that's the only lick I got in.
Oh, my gosh.
But he'd fight with others, and he was fighting with a guy named McNair one time on the after deck house. And though McNair would get him down and beating him up real good, and we'd let him go. And Lawson would get McNair down, we'd pull him off. So they fought until they both give out, and then. But you get 120 men together, that's going to happen.
Yeah, they have to release some energy, huh?
Well, I guess you might call it that.
What other kinds of things did you do for entertainment besides playing cards and fighting?
I don't know. I would read, of course, and listen to the radio, and several just plain little games like AC Deucey. I remember that we'd play quite a bit, and card games like that, and cards we'd play. Sometimes we'd play for match stems, and sometimes for a little bit of money, but never anything big. I remember one night I played poker until midnight. I had to go on watch, and it was on from midnight to 4 a.m., and I went back down there at 4 a.m. That same game was still going. So I sat down and played then until breakfast time, and I won $100.
Wow, that's big money.
Oh, boy, was that big money. Next night, I lost it in 15 minutes playing blackjack. Easy come, easy go.
Yep. Well, what did you do with your money that you made in the service? Did you send it home, or did you lose it in card games?
Oh, no, I never lost it in card games. I never lost any more than I won, because I didn't play all that often. And even if I did, mostly it was for pennies or nickels, and not big money like that one particular game. But I had an allotment going home to my parents, and so I didn't have an awful lot of money and didn't need money. I had a bunk every night and three meals a day, and I used to smoke cigars, but they were dirt cheap, and I just put in my time and called it living.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there any alcohol on the boat?
No. And don't call it a boat now. it's a ship.
Oh, a ship. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, there's no alcohol, and I don't remember any in Alaska at all, but when we were down in the South Pacific, the Liberty Party would get issued 2 bottles of beer, and you could take it over on the island and drink it, but you could never drink it aboard ship.
Mm.
And this one time I was in charge of the party going over there, and so I went around getting people's names to go on the boat, you know, over to the island, and what we the way we'd work that, when they'd call the names, they'd give them two bottles of beer, and they'd climb down the ladder and get in the boat, and then somebody would get the officer's attention on the boat, and the ones that didn't want to go, they'd climb back up and leave their beer down there, see?
Mm.
So then the group that went over there on the island would have extra beer that way.
They didn't trade it? They just left it with them?
The beer?
Right.
The men that didn't want to go, they would do us a favor by doing that. You know, they'd get their beer, and then they'd climb back aboard and stay there, and we'd keep the beer.
Okay, so they didn't want anything for it. They weren't trying to get money off you for their beer or anything?
Oh, no. They just do it as a favor for us, yeah. So that way we'd get extra beer.
Oh, so that was a rare thing, though.
Oh, yeah. That was rare. We just about every bunch that went over there would do that, yeah, but... you know, we wouldn't do that very often. I mean, we wouldn't there at the islands. We'd out on the water most of the time.
Right.
But we'd go into these main islands for refueling. Sometimes we'd refuel at sea.
How did you refuel at sea?
Well, it'd throw a rope over and we'd get a hold of that, and then they'd tie it to a hose, and then they'd bring the hose over and from the tanker, and of course connect it to our fuel tank, and then they'd pump the fuel to us, and the tanks got full, and they'd just pull the hose back.
Did they have tankers in Alaska, or was that in the South Pacific that you used tankers?
In the South Pacific, don't remember, and I'm quite sure we didn't refuel at sea in Alaska. We would go to Dutch Harbor or Kodiak, and I think mostly Dutch Harbor, yeah. And, of course, Adak, you know, when we invaded Adak, it was supposed to have been Japs there, but they got away. And so after a couple of days, they found out there was no Japanese there, and we went into the harbor, but and those sunken Japanese ships, there's several of them sunk there in the harbor, and the mast is sticking up out of the water, so we went in there and looking for a place to anchor or tie up, and anyway, we got orders right then to go to Hawaii. We didn't even anchor, we just made a circle around the harbor and came out and headed southeast.
Oh, so you didn't see much of that invasion of Kiska then?
Oh, yeah, we were there. And but the invasion of Kiska, it turned out to be no Japanese there, and of course, we didn't know that. And of course, there had landings at certain different places, and then they started shooting at each other, and several of our men were killed by their own friendly fire, but
mm-hmm.
And so that's all the firing that was done there. There was no Japanese to shoot at.
Right. Did you see anything on that was going on land from where you were?
No. But we were there. But you know, it was very little firing that went on, and we saw the landings, of course, but there was nothing else to see.
And did you get any news of what was happening when you were on board the ship? Or did you hear about it later?
You mean that was happening right there on the island?
Right, uh-huh.
I don't remember that specifically. I think we probably heard about it right after it happened, because I remember that there was no Japanese there, and we knew that right away, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it took a couple of days for them to actually make sure there was none there, but yeah, we heard about it right away.
Okay. And did you say you were at ADAC when you got called back to the South Pacific or to Hawaii?
Right, right. And I remember when we left there, we escorted one or two ships from there to Hawaii. And two or three days out of the Aleutians, the weather started getting warmer, of course, and some of these men started stripping off, and boy, I said, are they going to get a suntan? So, me being from Texas, I knew what the sun could do. And I told several of them, I said, you can't get a suntan like that. You're going to get blistered. Oh, no, 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 I'm going to get a suntan. Oh, boy, two or three days in that sun, they wound up with blisters for sure. Well, I told you so.
I bet they were in a lot of pain.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Those blisters can be painful, yeah. But, you know, they'll heal up pretty soon, so. No real damage done. It's just that they wouldn't listen. So we went to Hawaii, and I remember this one man went to the hospital for some reason, and they were going to keep him there, but he found out we were going to San Francisco, and he got out of the hospital somehow and went with us. So we escorted some ships from Hawaii to San Francisco, and I guess we must have gone for some repair and remodeling then. We did that three or four times.
Well,
then right back to the South Pacific.
And what did you do in the South Pacific then?
Same as we did in the Aleutians, you know, sweet mines, and we'd go with the fleet wherever they went, and we made several invasions. Let's see, I've got some of them written down here. In the Marshall Islands, at Kwajalein, we could see the Army and their Marines, I forget which it was. They would take one island, and this one place in particular, we could see them wading from one island to the other with their rifles above their head.
Oh.
And so there, Kwajalein, let's see, in Inuvituk, and several Phoenix Islands. Well, we crossed the equator, went to the Phoenix Islands. And we made several invasions there in those different islands. And went to New Guinea. We were at, went to Port Moresby, but that's another time we went there and didn't even anchor. We got orders to go somewhere else. So we went around the tip of New Guinea to Lae. And from there we went up to the Admiralty Islands, and that's where we made it. Mine sweep through there, and when we went in through the harbor, there were some tree houses there that the Japanese had, and we asked permission from the admiral to shoot them, so we did. We made that circle around, filled those tree houses full of bullets, and then after that, we went to Hollandia, New Guinea. And now that Hollandia has a different name, they call it Jayapura, J-A-Y-A-P-U-R-A. Mm. I don't know why they renamed it.
Hmm.
But we went into started into the harbor there to sweep mines. And, you know, and I can honestly say that that is the only time that I was really afraid of what was going to happen. We started into the harbor, and we could see these shells hitting in front of us, the Japanese shooting at us, and we had orders to go in there. Of course, there's nothing we could do but go, and we kept getting closer and closer to these shells. And then we had an Australian was in command, and he saw what was happening, and he yelled on the ship-to-ship radio. He says, you know, it's come out of there, come out of there. He said, you can't win the war all by yourself. Boy, as soon as we got that order, we did a full right rudder, and out of there we came. And then the cruisers started pounding the Japanese, and they were shooting right over our head. And you could see those shells, those 8-inch shells, one right after the other. And they pounded the harbor with them. And then we got orders to go back in there, and we did, of course. And then we were, with all our guns, we were shooting it all around the harbor. And this one man, the trainer, had his gun trained wrong, and he was shooting over the harbor into the jungle. So we were all kind of laughing about that, you know. Here he is shooting into the jungle, and he's supposed to be shooting down at in the harbor. So we found out later that the Japanese abandoned the harbor and they went to the jungle.
Oh.
So if anybody hit a Jap, he was doing it.
Oh.
But we shot the place up real good and made it back out of there.
Sounds like that must have been a pretty exciting time. I mean, with all the action going on, that must have been a big deal for a young guy.
It's a strange thing, like I mentioned there before. You don't notice, you don't pay attention to what's going. I guess you're so hepped up or something that it doesn't really strike you. You're just doing what you're supposed to be doing. And that's it. I remember this one fellow was with the 3-inch gun, the big guns, big for us, and they fired so many shells that the paint melted and was running down, and this gunner mate yelled, ceasefire. He says, I gotta repaint that thing. Of course, nobody paid any attention to him. They kept firing, and all the paint melted and ran down, of course, and he did have to repaint it, but...
But not immediately.
No, not immediately, that's for sure.
Well, were there guys, other guys that you remember quite well because they were unique in some way?
You know, I've been asked a question before. We didn't have any heroes, if you want to put it that way. We had... one man in particular I remember from Oklahoma, Enid, Oklahoma, and his nickname, of course, was Okie. But he was a machinist. And one time we were escorting some freighters, and one of them broke down. And so we had to make circles around him and to protect him while he was dead in the water. And they couldn't get it started, so we... they wanted to know if we had somebody that could work on their engine. So we sent this Okie over there in a breeches buoy. And water was pretty rough. And so we made it over there with him all right. And it didn't take him less than a half hour. He had that thing going. And, of course, then we had to bring him back. And he dipped down in the water that time. We got so close and... like I said, the ocean was pretty rough. Well, I thought we were going to drown him, but we got him back all right. When, you know, I think that that was pretty good on his part for doing that. That was a dangerous situation.
Yep.
But we got him over there and back all right. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every in a war like that, every effort is important.
Yeah.
Everybody plays a role that is important to keep things going.
Oh, yeah. You got to do your assignment. If you don't do your assignment, then things not going to work because it all has to be coordinated.
Right. Well, did your family know where you were when you were in the South Pacific or in Alaska? Were you able to tell them?
Yeah, Yeah, they knew where I was. Like when I was at home, and of course when I went back, I had no idea where we were going to go after we left San Francisco. So I left a little code with them, and I told them when I write my letters that you know, I would have this code to go by to tell them where I'm going, and so they knew. Yeah.
Mm.
Well, it was against the rules to tell them where you're going, because you know, that's like I forget what the saying was, a slip of the lip can sink a ship or something like that.
Right.
So, but where they were in East Texas, I could tell them wherever I'm going, and they're not gonna sink a ship by knowing.
Right. Did you see evidence that they censored your mail?
Oh yeah. Well, my incoming mail they never censored, but they censored all the mail going out. And the officers did that. I don't know where they had certain ones designated to do it, and I don't know how well they read and censored, but oh yeah, every letter going out had to be censored.
Mm.
We had what they call V-mail that the government printed, and it was a little fold-up thing that you could write that and then fold it up, but you wouldn't seal it. And the censor would do that. He would seal it and send it. And it was free. You didn't have to pay for that mail.
But they looked for things like you telling them where you were at or what was happening from you, from a insider's perspective. They would cut that out or X it out somehow.
Well, I don't know how they did that, and I my family never did tell me that so and so was censored. I don't know how they did that.
Whether
they blacked it out or cut it out, I don't know.
Did you stay in contact with your future wife when you were in the Pacific?
No, I didn't know her then.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, it wasn't until you came back.
That's right. When I got transferred from my ship to Great Lakes Naval Base, is when I met her.
Oh, okay.
See, she was in this diet kitchen, and we used to go. You know, they had several kitchens around the base and dining rooms, and we could put an SP armband on. We could go anywhere we wanted to. So we went over to her her place, and I met her over there, and her place had a special diet kitchen and a special room, dining room, for the ex-prisoners and people that had to have special diets. So I'd go over there and meet with them. You know, was not supposed to, but I did. So we went together there quite a while, and she got out of the Navy, and her home was up there in the Chicago suburbs. So I'd go over there and see her and back and forth, and she'd come up and see me. And when I got out and went home, came back up there and got married.
Oh, okay. So you were out of the service then?
Yeah, when we got married, yeah.
Okay.
So that's why I got out.
So that you could get married and...
Yeah, well, when I signed up, I meant to stay 30 years. But after I met her, I had to change my mind.
Women can do that, right?
They have quite an influence.
So what kind of profession did you have after you left the Navy?
I was a cabinet maker.
Oh, like kitchen cabinets, that kind of thing?
Yeah. We'd build all kind of cabinets and stereo equipment and music, you know, all the kind of cabinets and not real furniture, but some of it we'd make pretty nice furniture, yeah. And I did that for about 12 years, and then I was advanced, I guess you'd call it, to the office, and I would go out and measure the houses for cabinets, and all kind of cabinets, and then I'd come back to the office and make a drawing of them and turn it in for, you know, for the production part of it.
Oh, okay. Did
so
you?
I liked that. That was a good job.
So the Navy didn't train you for that?
No, I didn't. No training. I was bosun's mate, so no, there was no training for that. Like welding, for instance, you know, we had a welder aboard ship. He was going to teach me how to weld one time, but I wasn't enthusiastic about it, so that didn't go very far.
Mm.
No, I didn't learn any trade in the Navy. So I learned a cabinet maker on my own, and, you know, with help from others. And now, when I was in Illinois, I worked for a big company up there in the boiler house making steam. Big coal-burning boilers.
Oh.
And I worked at that 2 or 3 years, and then I was a water softener. You know, that was that took quite a bit of work doing that, but just about anybody could do it. And that's when I talked my wife into coming south, and that's when I went to work in the cabinet shops.
Mm. What kind of wood did you like to work with?
Oh, we worked mostly with ash and oak and what was called imitation mahogany. Right offhand, I can't remember the name of it. And we worked with some walnut. Walnut's real easy to work with. It's a hard wood, but it's easy to work with.
Mm.
But we worked mostly with ash.
Okay. And did you retire out of that business?
Yeah. I worked for this one cabinet place for 25 years and 8 months.
Wow.
And retired. And when we came down here, the kids were small, and my wife wasn't working, but, you know, she was a registered nurse, and she was working part-time, and when the kids got big enough to take care of themselves, she went to work full-time and for a few years, and then she, instead of working 5 days, she started working four. But she worked 20 years in the emergency room on the night shift.
Oh, my gosh.
From 11 to 7.
Wow, that's a tough time.
Well, she kind of liked it because she could take care of the kids and all that and work, too. And well, I don't know how she did it with the sleep she got, but she did. And, you know, she had to take the kids to Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and swimming and just about anywhere they wanted to go, she could do it.
Mm. That's got to be a tough shift at the hospital and in the emergency room. That's.
Yeah, she said that she could write a book, but she never did, so.
I'll bet, yeah.
But she passed away, soon to be 9 years now. And
Oh, what happened to her? She must have been, well, she was in her 80s?
Yeah, she had a stroke and then she broke both arms, and so she was in the nursing home, couldn't feed herself or couldn't do anything for herself with two broken arms.
Oh, yeah.
So she had that osteoporosis, and, you know, that's the reason she broke her arm. So.
Oh.
And so she couldn't make it after that.
No.
But that's, like I said, it'll soon be 9 years. So now I live with my daughter and son-in-law, and I helped build this house.
Oh, did
we
you?
We have a great big garage and a workshop. We built it first, and then we built a house, and took right at 2 years. My son-in-law and I built most of the house.
Wow, that's nice.
So I've got my apartment on one side. I have a living room, bedroom, bathroom, have my old thermostat, heater and air conditioner.
Wow, that's a nice setup. You have your privacy, yet you're not just totally by yourself.
That's right. I can go to the kitchen anytime I want to.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nice.
And my daughter cooks for me and, you know, and all that, so. But I fix my own breakfast, you know. I pour my own cereal.
It sounds like you have a pretty good daughter, though.
Oh, yeah. She was a high school teacher for 17 years, and then she was assistant principal 14 years.
Wow.
So, and by the way, this letter you wrote me when you sent that package,
mm-hmm.
I let her read it, and she says that you are well coordinated.
Oh, really?
And she said that you write a nice letter, and it's everything is perfect.
Oh, that's very nice of her.
Well, I said that I told her, I said, I'll tell her that. Because, you know, my daughter knows those things. After teaching so long and then administration so long, that she can judge things like that.
Oh, you made me nervous when you said she was a teacher and a principal. I thought I might not get a good grade.
No, she said you get a good grade on that letter.
But I did call your ship a boat there, too. I noticed it later. I thought, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, there's a difference.
Yeah, I did know that, but I messed up there, so.
Well, yeah. You know, another little thing I'd like to tell you, like when we went to Saipan, we made the invasion there, and of course that was one of the biggest battles in the Pacific. And one of our planes were shot down, and we got orders to go pick him up when he landed in the ocean, of course. And so they didn't put my boat in the water. They put the captain's gig in the water. His boat is the same as mine, except it's dressed up and got a canopy over it and all that. So they went out to pick him up, and the Japs started shooting at them. So they yelled from the bridge in the megaphone and told them, come on back, come back, come back. So here this guy is out there floating in his Mae West life jacket. So then after a few minutes, well, our planes came over then and bombed this gun that was shooting at him. And then they went on and picked him up and got him in the boat all right and started back. And the doggone motor conked out then.
Oh, no.
And here they were floating out there. So then they had to put my boat in the water. And I had to go out and tow them in.
Oh, boy.
with the rescued pilot. So then, of course, they brought him in there, and the doctor looked him over and everything, and they cleaned him up and dried out his uniform, and then the boat took him back. I don't remember now just where they took him, but anyway, they took him back, and then he was flying again the next day. In another plane. And during that same battle, they shot down a Japanese plane. And so we also got orders to go pick him up. And we're steaming full speed over there where we figured he's going to land. And he saw us coming, so he cut his harness loose and committed suicide.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. So then, after that happened, the captain asked the senior officer about permission to go over and pick up his parachute. So we did, and got his parachute aboard, and you could see right where he cut the harness.
Oh.
So we took his parachute and cut it up in pieces and passed it around to the crew.
So did you keep your piece?
I kept it, and came back and offered it to my girlfriend, and she looked at it and she said, oh, real silk. I said, give me that thing. I took it away from her and wouldn't let her have it. So So I kept it and had it until recently, the last few years, and I don't know what happened to it, but I don't have it anymore.
Well, maybe it'll show up somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know who took it. I hope it didn't get thrown out, but I don't know where it is now.
Sometimes small things like that can get misplaced.
Yeah. That was one of my souvenirs.
Did you have any other souvenirs that you brought back from the war?
Yeah, I got some Japanese clips, rifle clips, with the bullets in there that we got on the Guadalcanal. When I got transferred from my ship, and they put us over on Guadalcanal and waiting for transportation back, and we were there 29 days. And so we used to roam around the island, and we went to this army camp. Nobody was there but the cooks. So we asked them where we could go to get some souvenirs, and he told us where some of the battles were up on the in the jungles up there. And so we went and found these Japanese dugouts where they dug out of the side of the hills, and they would had the beds carved in the dirt where they'd sleep in there. And we found a bunch of gas masks and bullets and all that. And the gas mask had already rotted, so except for the lens, and I brought some of those home with me, and some of the gun clips with the bullets. And I've got one of them on my keychain right now.
Oh, so you did keep those for all these years.
Oh, yeah, I've got more of them.
It gives you something to start a conversation with and tell people about your war experience.
Oh, yeah. And when we shot at that plane in the Aleutians, I've got one of the casings. And later, several of us would get these 20-millimeter shells and take them apart and take all the powder out of it and everything. So I've got one of those in the casing, I guess you call it, sitting in my bathroom right now.
Oh, so you did grab some good mementos of that time.
Yeah. When we were doing that, we were taking these shells apart and taking the powder out. One of the officers came. We were way below deck in the engineering department. He caught us doing that. He bawled me out good because I was senior man down there. He said, "You ought to know better than that." Well, I do know better. He says, "All right, take all of them up and throw them overboard." So we all marched up there and threw them overboard and went and got us some more and went back down there and finished our job.
Young guys have to have something to occupy their time, right?
Yeah, you always find something to do. We did our own laundry, a lot of us did, and we'd hang it down in the engineering department where it was a lot warmer down in there, dry. You'd hang your clothes down there to dry them out and all. But some of the men would hire their laundry done, but I was born poor and I was able to do my own.
Well, you probably had the time to put into it periodically, right?
Oh, yeah. You had plenty of time. We'd stay and watch like 4 hours at a time. And in the war zone, you'd be on watch more regular, but you had plenty of time to do that. And you weren't going anywhere.
Right.
All you had was a ship that was 316 feet and 4 inches long and 39 feet wide. That was your territory.
Right. Not that much room for 120 guys.
No, it wasn't. And, of course, in the Aleutians, when it was always so rough and everything, and you'd go to bed at night, your bunk is held up with, it's secured on one side and it's hung by chains on the outside so you can fold it up. And you'd lay up in there, you'd put your arm around one chain and your foot around the other chain to keep from falling out. It's so rough. And sometimes it's so rough it couldn't even cook in the kitchen, and we'd get cold cuts, and these big kettles, I guess it must have been about 30-gallon kettles, and they'd fill them about half full of soup. Otherwise, it'd splash all over. So we'd have soup and cold sandwiches.
In rough weather, that's all the best they could do for you.
Right, right.
Was the food pretty good aboard the ship?
Yeah, it was good. I liked it, but you know, some people would gripe about it, but those kind of gripe about anything. I don't know if they were used to better or they just wanted to gripe. We had this one kid that came aboard as a replacement, and one morning we had pancakes for breakfast, and so he was late getting out on the job. The chief asked him, you know, where you been? He said, well, I had to finish breakfast. He said, well, everybody else is up here. Yeah, but he said those pancakes were so good, he said, I ate 17 of them.
Oh, gee. Oh, my gosh.
Young kid from Kansas, I forget his name, but he gained about 15 or 20 pounds the first month he was there.
Jeez. Well, it was probably hard to get some exercise on the boat, wasn't it? Or on the ship, I'm sorry.
I don't think anybody paid any attention to that. There was never any exercise routine. So I can't say that anybody got the proper exercise. I know it was never a group or anything. I guess it was just never even thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we were tied up for that 31 days up in Kodiak, we would get out on the dock, the entire crew.
Mm-hmm.
Would get out on the dock and do exercises. That was a requirement.
Okay.
But out at sea, never did.
Okay. Well, I've had you talking for about an hour and 20 minutes. Do you think you could stand just a couple more questions, or would you like to cut it off here?
You can go ahead and ask me anything you want to. I've got till lunchtime.
Okay. Okay. You said you were in Dutch Harbor quite a few times. Do you remember seeing any of the aftermath of the bombing there when you were on the island?
No. To be honest with you, I didn't even know it had been bombed.
Mm.
I found out about that later. And, so I didn't see anything. If I did, I don't remember. It didn't register.
Okay. Did you ever encounter any native people on any of the Aleutian Islands when you were on them?
No, none whatsoever.
Okay.
Now, down the South Pacific we did some, yeah.
Okay.
But not in the Aleutians. Of course, I know, like, Attu, for instance, they'd already been shipped to Japan. And Kiska, I don't know what happened to them, but I never did see any.
Okay. So where were you when you were discharged from, well, first of all, where were you when the war ended?
At Great Lakes Naval Base.
Okay, so you'd already been returned to the States.
Right.
And what did you, what was your thinking when you heard the war had ended?
Well, I don't remember particularly. Of course, we were all glad and we heard about it and all that. But, you know, we were young men and we'd been through it all. And, if things like that, I guess, is just... not as important to, you know, I remember it, but I can't say that it was a big deal. We were glad of it, of course, but it had been a while since we were actually been in the war. You know, I was transferred in, I think it was August of 44, and see, that was 2 years later.
Oh, so you went to Great Lakes after you were discharged in 44?
No, when I was transferred from my ship.
Oh, okay.
You know, they, actually, when I left my ship, they were transferring people back to the States for what they call new construction. You know, they would get a cadre of men to put with recruits to run a new ship. And that's what they sent us back for, because we were experienced. Well, when we got to San Francisco, and the man in charge of reassignments was good enough to send me to Great Lakes instead of putting me aboard another ship. And I still thank him for that. I was there out there quite a while, and I figured I'd just about done as much as I could, or I was glad to get to go to Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm. And look,
so
at
they put me in the police department up there, and so I did my thing.
And look how good it turned out. You met your wife there.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Wonder how that happened. Here I am, an East Texas cotton farmer, and I go around halfway around the world, and I meet a woman in Illinois.
Right, yeah.
And she was from New Jersey, and her daddy got transferred to Chicago, and that's how she happened to be there. So, you know, strange things happen.
Yeah, yeah. They sure do.
So we lived together 55 and a half years, so.
Yeah.
And she came down here from the north. She'd never been south before, but she managed it all right.
Yeah, sometimes us Yankee girls don't make it very well in the south.
You know, I know quite a few of them, though, now. Like, we had this telephone manufacturing here, and of course they brought men in from other areas to the officers, I guess you call it, the engineers and all that came with the telephone company, and there's a whole bunch of them here that are retired, and the military. You see, we've got Barksdale Air Force Base, and after they do their time and they get discharged, they retire here, and there's hundreds of them from all over everywhere.
Oh. Well, it's nice living down there from what I saw. I can see why they would go.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice. I like it. You know, your buildings are air-conditioned. Just about every building you go into is air-conditioned and well-heated in the wintertime. Sometimes in the hospitals or doctor's office, you go in there, you freeze to death, and you come outside, it feels good.
Yeah, I know that feeling that you're talking about.
Yeah, you said you'd been to Natchitoches. Where's your hometown?
Well, I spent 18 years in Lower Michigan.
Yeah.
And then I was in the upper part of Michigan another 8 years, I guess, and then I moved to Alaska. So I've been in Alaska since I was about 26.
Oh.
And I'm not 26 anymore.
Oh, you're probably no more than 30, though.
No, no, I must sound young, but I'm not. Next week I'll be 53.
53?
Yes.
53.
Yep.
Well, my daughter that I was just telling you about is next month or so, she's going to be 62.
Oh, my gosh. We're close in age.
And my youngest daughter is 4.5 years younger than that. My son is, he's going to be 63 next month.
Oh, my.
And in August, I'm going to be 91.
Oh, boy.
A lot of people don't think I'm that old, but I was born in 1921.
Yeah,
it makes me 91.
Yeah, you know, you seem like a young guy at heart, and in your voice, you have a real strong voice. And
oh, yeah, I plan to be around a while.
Well, good. I think the South is good for longevity. It keeps people going.
Well, I don't know if it's that or not, but I exercise every day, and we got some good doctors around here and lots of good pills.
What kind of exercise do you like to do?
I get up at 5:30 every morning, and I exercise until 6, and that's just bending and twisting, and I got some 2-pound weights that I do arm exercises with, and leg kicks, and then I lean over the chair and, you know, stretch my back and shoulders, and it's just generally like that, and I walk around. I don't do much walking, but I do walk inside the house quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Big circle around inside the house, and I did that yesterday for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So then I've got a woodwork shop that I work in, and right now my son-in-law's got an old car in there he's rebuilding, so I don't have much room to work, but I spend some time in there.
Well, that's good. It sounds like you keep active.
I do, and I do little repair jobs at the church, and I just did one last week, and I build things for them, tables and little rostrums and different things, and we have the Wednesday night suppers at church, and I work there in the kitchen, and the hardest part of serving a meal like that is cleaning up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you have to do all that. And during Lent right now, we have a fish fry every Friday night for 7 Fridays. You know, the men's club make extra money for the church.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to keep busy.
Yeah, it sounds like you do.
Do a lot of yard work, and we've got flower beds galore, and that. That takes a lot of work, and so I try to keep busy.
Yeah, well, that's good for a person, no matter what age, right?
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah. Well, look, you said that you had another book that you might send me about Kiska, huh?
I do.
Yeah.
Actually, I put it in the mail for you yesterday.
Oh, okay, that's good. All right, I appreciate that. I appreciate the other things you sent me, and that story, that tattoo boy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a real neat story.
Oh, good. It's one that hasn't been told before, so I thought it might be popular and people might be interested in hearing it.
Well, I read it, and I think just about anybody would like it. And I know that every chance I get, I tell people about the war and the Aleutians, and so many people don't know about it, and I think they should. So all that you can get out on it, put out for people to read or hear about, that's good.
Well, we're trying. We've got some other things in the works right now that we should have printed later this year, and I'll make sure you get copies of them.
Oh, I sure would appreciate that, because that little over a year I spent up there is, you know, that was, now I would class it as torture. Oh, that was a terrible year with that weather and the fog and all that. It's just, and the cold and ice and, but, you know, when you're a young man, you can do it, but you still remember it.
Right, Right. And did it seem like torture when you were there, or just in retrospect?
Well, it was inconvenient, and it worked on you. You didn't like it, but you didn't let it hinder your work. You did what you're supposed to do, and all that, and of course that's what I've tried to do all my life. But it was bad. It was really bad, and I wouldn't want to repeat it, and I wouldn't want anybody else to, unless like people that live there. If they like it, more power to them. But it's not for me. So Anchorage is not all that bad, is it?
Well, this winter's been a little rough, but no, it's, you know, the weather's a little bit more milder because of the ocean effect.
Yeah.
You know, we still get winds, but not as bad as the Aleutians.
Yeah.
It's just been frigidly cold, and we've gotten, how many inches? We've gotten 152 inches of snow this year, I think it is.
Yeah,
so it's, my muscles are well developed this year. I've been shoveling a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, like I said, you just put up with it.
Right.
You live there, and you tolerate it.
Right. And if you don't know any better, it just doesn't seem so bad, right?
Yeah, that's what I lived up in Illinois, and I said to myself, I know better. I know where there's a warmer place.
Well, after we went to Natchitoches and found out how nice it was one November, we thought, boy, it's pretty nice down there in Louisiana. We should take a look at that.
Yeah. My daughter and son-in-law and I went to Natchitoches two or three months ago, I guess, and my son-in-law is from Kansas, and he really liked Natchitoches. You know, he said, this is really neat. And we went to that famous restaurant there they call Les Anges, and I mean, that place is known for all around here. Everybody says you don't go to Natchitoches without going to Les Anges, you know. And it's good. We went to a museum down there. You know, the French settled Natchitoches. In fact, it's the oldest town in Louisiana.
Oh, that's right.
Natchitoches. And so this old fort that they had there, it's been rebuilt, and they had a man explaining the whole thing as you go around, and it's real interesting, yeah.
Ah, well, we hope to get back there again soon, because our friend's down there quite often.
You know, they made that movie, can't think of the name of it now, with Dolly Parton.
Oh, I know which one you mean. We stayed in a bed and breakfast there, and right across the street was where they filmed most of it.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name now.
Oh, I can't either right this minute. But anyway, they made that movie there, and it was really a good movie. I've seen it two or three times, and the last time I saw it was even better than the first time.
That is a good movie.
Yeah. What? Steel Magnolias.
That's right. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
A lot of
all right.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. You know, what I'll do is we have some people that professionally transcribe these interviews.
Yeah.
And once that gets done, I'll send it back to you to take a look at and see if we have any questions about it, or see how you feel about it after you have a chance to take a look.
All right. I appreciate that, and I'll be glad to cooperate any way I can.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you.
You take care and have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.